that he, like Senator Hayden, is a native son of the West, having been born in Olympia, Washington, and having launched a career in the West with the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, went on to achieve national distinction in a field of national service in the great citadels of power and authority and responsibility in the East. He began his career with the J. Walter Thompson Company in 1929 in the San Francisco office, moving on to Detroit, then assuming the presidency of that great and important concern, and serving as its chairman since 1964. His love for books and his devotion to such causes as we typify today is well known. Perhaps you do not appreciate, however, that he has earned the Benjamin Franklin Award from the printing industry of the United States as recently as 1965 for his intensive artistry and interest in this field, and that in addition to being the author of a book we should all read, How to Build a Poor Man's Morgan Library, he and his charming wife, Mrs. Strauss, operate one of the most interesting and distinguished hand presses in our country, the Silverado Press. It's my great pleasure now to introduce the speaker of the day, who will speak to the subject, New Star in Tempe, Mr. Norman H. Strauss. Mr. Strauss.
President Durham, Senator Hayden, Miss Susan Hayden, representing the Hayden family, Governor Goddard, members of the legislature, trustees, regents, Reverend Johnson, and the indispensable associates of the Arizona State University Library, ladies and gentlemen. No greater privilege could be extended to anyone who loves and collects books than the opportunity to participate in the dedication of a great new university library. My credentials for being here on this memorable occasion must hinge on enthusiasm rather than on substantive academic merit. This enthusiasm arises not only out of the love of books, but also from a deep sense of personal indebtedness to the printed word. My first purchase of books took place when I was 14. It was a secondhand set of Teddy Roosevelt's Winning of the West. The purchase price was $2, half my week's salary from a secondhand furniture store where I worked after school hours and on Saturday. My latest important acquisition only a few weeks ago was a copy of Pindar, published in Rome in 1515, the first book printed in Greek in that city. The difference in semantics may have been noted. The beginning collector, limited in funds which may be committed to books, purchases. The mature collector, who has achieved a double standard of monetary value, acquires. For him, the price marked in a book or a manuscript or quoted in an antiquarian book catalog has no relationship to any other price tag in our marketing economy. It is the pearl of great price. Nothing else matters. And a wife who has mastered the difficult art of living with a collector understands this quite illogical situation and would never think of chiding her husband by saying, "Why, dear, I could have bought a new fur coat for what you paid for that beaten-up old volume." An ingredient of excitement lies deep in the heart of the rabid collector who finds no end to the books he must acquire and no limits to the size of his library. He is called a bibliomaniac because there is a touch of madness in his philosophy and in his actions. Not madness in pathological terms, but in the sense of Webster's fourth alternative definition of the word, wild excitement or enthusiasm. I submit that this quality must also be at the heart and in the total environment of a great library, a sense of excitement implicit in its holdings and a contagious component of enthusiasm in their use. If I were a man of cloth, and were to pronounce a benediction on the Charles Trumbull Hayden Library, it would most certainly be in these terms, something about the joy and excitement that passeth understanding. I grant you that in these days we tend to think of excitement as being more appropriate to the adolescent or immature mind in search of transitory satisfaction. However, there is a nobler and more enduring excitement to be found in the higher emotions. Let us think of excitement in terms of stirring up or arousing the mind and provoking our imagination in the search of new ideas or values, a kind of excitement that calls forth our ideals into the world of action. Surely we can find the richest source of such excitement in the library around which this university is organized. Arizona State University has grown rapidly to meet the needs not only of an expanding population, but also a swiftly escalating need and hunger for higher education. During the early stages of accelerated growth, it is understandable that a library's resources might fall behind other facilities and services. Buildings and faculty demand priority during such a period. They can be brought into being quickly. A library must grow in its own pattern. Your library has grown remarkably in these recent years, but I detect no complacency here. In fact, it is reassuring that in the studies prepared by your librarian, Dr. Covey, in 1964 and 1966, there is frank recognition that based on a range of indices, your library still falls short of the goals it must reach if it is to serve the ultimate needs of a great university. A recent feature article in Life magazine is entitled Storehouse of Scholarship, which is about as perfect a definition of a great library as one could come by. It deals with the Widener Library at Harvard University, the biggest university in the world and one of the great institutions of our Western civilization. The article quotes Shakespearean scholar G.L. Kittredge as saying, "You could destroy all the other Harvard buildings, and with Widener left standing, still have a university." Then goes on to say that the library is a major reason for Harvard's greatness, for this immense reservoir of knowledge pulls scholars like a magnet from every part of the world to study and teach at Harvard. And there is a genuine entrepreneurial spirit in the 473-man staff of Harvard Library, described as forever on the jump, adding the latest publications and searching for old works to fill out the gaps of the past. Faculty members collaborate closely with the library staff in advice on needs. They also act as book scouts themselves as they travel in this country and abroad. Antiquarian bookmen throughout the world are well informed on Harvard desiderata, and choice items find their way to Cambridge through many channels. This is equally true of Yale, Columbia, Harvard, and other university libraries. Even the upstart University of Texas, in its hurry to catch up, has been defoliating auctions on both sides of the Atlantic to the consternation of the Ivy League contenders, who in the past have had things pretty much their own way. With the dedication of the Charles Trumbull Hayden Library, you have made a visual and physical commitment to equally high goals. The fact that the library has been chosen by three national organizations to receive an award of merit for achievement of excellence in architectural design confirms that the library is to become a center of excitement on your campus. How can one look at such magnificent architecture without a sense of confidence in the fact that it will become one of the great reservoirs of man's knowledge in the Southwest? And by the very size of this edifice, you affirm in physical space that the library resources must almost triple during the next decade. It is not without interest that the present 205,000 square feet of enclosed space in the new library is equal to five football fields. Without reflecting in any way on the importance of the manly sport of physical contact, it is a source of some satisfaction that the area for equally strenuous intellectual contact with books justifies a multiple of five. The challenge of the next 10 years of library growth will be a difficult one. There is the challenge to keep pace with the growth of new materials, and there is the challenge of filling out and enriching the subject areas of most direct relevance to the various curricula. The proliferation of publications of all sorts, books, periodicals, monographs, and so on, places enormous burdens on the library of today, if it is to maintain its vitality and pertinence to our times. As there are limits to funds available for acquisition, a high degree of discretion must be exercised in selection. In 1953, the Library of Congress made its last attempt to estimate the quantity of publishing being done worldwide and came up with annual figures of 300,000 for books, 70,000 for periodicals, 30,000 for newspapers, and 17,000 for maps. Only 3 years of such publishing would produce enough printed material to fill this library to overflowing. At the annual Frankfurt Book Fair in late September, over 188,000 volumes were shown from 2,500 publishing houses from 52 countries. 60,000 of these volumes were new publications. 30,000 people visited the fair, and the Times of London reported that Oxford University press stand collapsed under the weight of learning, as a bystander told their stringer from Rome. Meanwhile, knowledge becomes increasingly specialized, placing additional burdens on library acquisition. For example, according to the recent issue of Psychiatry and Social Science Bookshelf, there are 214 currently active journals in as narrow a field as psychiatry, and an estimated 250,000 original medical articles are published annually in 50 languages. Only through the closest collaboration between the library staff and the university's administrators and faculty can the hazardous channel between the scylla of newly published knowledge and the charybdis of available funds and space be navigated with success and satisfaction to all. There is much about this new library as it gets underway that promises an almost electric environment for the future. Nothing could be more in keeping with the principle of excitement in a library than the commitment of the Charles Trumbull Hayden Library to the idea that OpenStax not only familiarizes the student with man's greatest cultural resource, but stimulates him to pursue learning beyond the classroom requirements. Open shelves encourage the serendipity element in research, the discovery of information and ideas by fortunate accident. No research can be complete without some degree of browsing, and it is of interest to note that the word browse means not only to glance through a book or a library and so on in a leisurely way, but also to feed on or nibble at or to graze on. It is all to the end of feeding the mind and imagination and sustaining the excitement of the chase after the elusive fact or idea. As a dairyman friend of mine once put it tersely, no browsing, no milk. The potential contributions of the library in areas well beyond the requirements of the curriculum become increasingly significant as we look at the kinds of human resource needs being created by our expanding economy and our increasingly complex social and political structures. Magnus Pike, fellow of the Royal Society of Edinburgh, in an article in the British publication The Listener, addresses himself to the kinds of human resources which our society today must look to the universities to provide. He writes, "Where university graduates are needed, and more liberally educated graduates than many who are now appearing, is first as the specialists, out of whose heads the new ideas come and on whose abilities we depend for the design of the complex processes and instruments that the operators operate. The second claimant need is for the men who, without being specialists themselves, understand what science is about and what kind of community they are living in, and that intellectual excellence is worth cultivating both for its own sake and for the purely materialistic advantage it gives in managing an industry and meeting the business of life." It seems to me that here again is where the great library has so much to contribute if these are the kinds of citizens we are to produce on our campuses. It is beyond the formal courses, with their textbooks, lectures, and seminars, that the student has the greatest opportunity to create lifelong interests in reading and thought, and the cultivation of intellectual excellence for its own sake. The very name of a course defines its limits. There are no limits within the walls and on the shelves and in the stacks of the library. As we have moved from the old entrepreneurial owner-manager type of business and industry to much larger units manned by professional management, as we see a closer relationship, if not interlocking interest, between business, government, and society, this humanistic ingredient about which Magnus Pike speaks has become of paramount importance in business too. It is also reassuring to learn that provision has been made for future electronic applications to facilitate the more routine requirements of library administration, and that a special room has been set aside for eventual computer and other data processing equipment. This might come as a shock to the medievalist, who favors a more cloistered environment and is possessed of a slavish reverence of the manual approach to library procedures. But stimulation in a library comes from ideas and not from archaic routines. I happen to have a special love of fine printing, done in handset type on dampened handmade paper and printed on a hand press. This is not practical for today's market. It is a luxury in which few collectors like myself can indulge. And it is true that such hand craftsmanship has continued to set new models of style and suggest higher standards of excellence in production. However, undoubtedly the most beautiful book published this year was a triumph of the machine and artists working in close collaboration, the reproduction of the 157 miniatures in the magnificent Catherine of Cleves Book of Hours owned by the Pierpont Morgan Library. We must continue to draw on the past for inspiration, refreshing the springs of imagination, and identifying ourselves more securely with the long history of man. But we must not slavishly worship forms and techniques that are incompatible with the environment in which we now live, no matter how longingly, how nostalgically we may look back on quieter, less complicated, less frenetic times. The great library of today must keep pace with the increasing demands for immediate accessibility of the widest possible range of material, including those often pertinent bits and pieces of information that provide sudden insights. I see nothing intellectually abhorrent in the idea that the scholar or researcher may be able to program his needs into a computer and thus save himself many hours of plodding research and enable him to cast his net over the widest span of relevant material. By comparison, Mortimer Adler's famed Syntopticon of Great Ideas may seem but the first crawling move in this direction. You are fortunate in your librarian in that he is a lover of books. It has the vision of the practical needs of this library if it is to meet its demands of the future. A good librarian has a built-in conflict of interest. He cannot be a great collector in personal terms, but he succeeds in his mission to the degree to which he sublimates this desire to collect by building a library for others, and to the extent to which he becomes a vicarious collector by adding continually to the riches of the library under his supervision. He is, in a sense, like a nun who may not have children of her own, but is a devoted mother to the children of others. But at some point in the building of a great library is the emotional involvement of the man who is ultimately responsible for the institution in which it exists. In the university, it is the president or chancellor. I have yet to meet the head of a great educational institution who does not express a sense of excitement about books and the desire to possess them. This feeling is immediately transferable to the mission of the library itself. And in this, again, you are indeed fortunate. A great library is not measured in numbers of volumes, but rather in the quality of its holdings. We must recognize that the world's great libraries have both quantity and quality in their resources. For this reason, no library, no librarian, or group of trustees of a library should even put a furthest limit on the growth of the library unless they are content to set an ultimate limit on greatness or on service to the community. There remains, however, the practical recognition that the needs of the curriculum must come first, and that budgets for libraries are never at the level that permits other than sporadic or exceptional purchases of the rare materials which make up the special collections and give color and stature to a university library. However, these are the library resources that attract scholars and teachers of exceptional capabilities and provide the magnet for distinguished visitors. These are the resources that also provide an additional center of cultural influence in the community surrounding or contiguous to the campus through exhibitions, lectures, and seminars. It is for this reason that I would like to devote the remainder of my talk to the excitement of special collections and the relationship of friends or associates organizations to them. Some months ago, I wrote the directors of 10 major public libraries to ask their views concerning the elements that may be recognized in the structure of a great library. One of those elements emphatically identified was special collections. The following excerpts are representative of the views of 8 of the 10 librarians who placed high priority in this area. Keith Domes, director of Carnegie Library in Pittsburgh, says he believes that special collections are the key to greatness in a public library. Emerson Greenaway, director of the Free Library of Philadelphia, a library rich indeed in its special collections, insists that it is important for each major library to develop special collections emphasizing some aspect of history or geography or subject. They might illustrate the history and growth of science, for example, or the history of the illustrated book. Philip J. McNiff, director of the Boston Public Library, believes that the reference and research services would include the special collections, the major historical subject resources which reveal the entire history of man and his cultural, social, and political development. It is these specialized resources that make the library great. Now, it may come as a surprise to some that public libraries rank their special collections so highly. And if these treasures mean so much to a city's library, how much more essential they must be to a great university. These special collections of books and manuscripts provide rich veins of ore for the student and scholar to mine. They weave the fabric of excellence into the library's holdings. They illumine the institution. One has but to name the Beinecke Library at Yale, Widener and Houghton Libraries at Harvard, the Lilly Library at the University of Indiana, Bancroft at Berkeley, and the William Andrews Clark at UCLA, to understand the importance of such great collections in creating an environment of intellectual quickening on those campuses. Individual patrons have, of course, worked closely with these libraries in providing the funds for the purpose of building special collections. But the recent development of friends or associates organizations has begun to build a broader base of interest and support by alumni and by the residents of the community most closely related to the university. Our tax laws encourage such gifts and support. And some of my more affluent friends have found that it's great fun to make the federal and state governments become partners in financing these special interests through tax deductibility, as a suggestion. As special collections grow in size and importance, they will inevitably play their part in attracting the outstanding teacher and the exceptional student. Equally important, in my opinion, is the manner in which special collections bring notable visitors to the campus. Your own Neininger meteorite collection is a case in point. I'm sure you must place great value on visitors of the stature of Nobel Prize winners such as Professor Harold Urey and National Academy of Science members such as Professor Harrison Brown and the eminent foreign scientists who have been attracted to Arizona State University as visiting professors. You have a start in this direction in the field of special library collections through your valuable holdings of the papers of Senator Carl Hayden and your recent remarkable acquisition of the 10,000-volume collection of the Yiddish poet and scholar Selig Heller of Chicago. You can take great pride in your Arizona roll, your wealth in the fields of 19th-century English literature, contemporary American and English literature, and your large Latin American collection. You should not be discouraged by the preeminence of Harvard, Yale, Columbia, and other universities in their special collections. In fact, you should not attempt to compete with them in their main strengths. These institutions are great in many areas, but they cannot be great in all. You can equal or surpass them in some. As Oliver Wendell Holmes said in his poet at the breakfast table, every library should try to be complete in something, if it were only the history of pinheads. Through your new Library Associates organization, there are opportunities to generate interest and support of the library's special collections in three ways. First, by involving many, many people in the library's activities through Associates membership. Their dues can underwrite occasional exhibits and programs of interest, can support the informational periodical to maintain contact with its members, and finance modest acquisitions of rare items which might not otherwise be available for purchase under normal budget policies. Second, by cultivating a special interest in the library among those who can occasionally afford to make substantial special gifts. These more affluent friends can and should be approached when an item or collection of special importance turns up on the horizon. It is regrettable, for example, that when your librarian had an opportunity to inspect a 1,500-item collection of the work of the artist and designer William Wilkie, including many of the blocks and plates of the work he did for John Henry Nash, one of the West's greatest first printers, it was not possible to find one or more sponsors who would underwrite the acquisition. Finally, just as there was a collector of media rights and an interested patron to assist in their acquisition, is it too much to expect that in this flourishing Salt River Valley, there may not be individuals who are collecting or who can be encouraged to collect in fields of special interest to the library with the thought of someday bequeathing those collections to the university? As an example, in 1964, a Mr. John Eastman, Jr. of New York presented to Colby College his 34-year accumulation of Thomas Mann literary material, including 76 first editions of Mann's books in German and English, 54 of them presentation copies, and a wide range of other autograph and manuscript material and memorabilia. No future scholarly research on Mann can be considered complete without reference to this exciting collection. And a friend of mine who died only recently and at too young an age built a splendid collection of English literature with the idea of giving it to his university. And all through his brief years of collecting, he regularly consulted the librarian to make certain that any rare item that he was considering was not duplicated in the library's collection. In this way, he collected with the library and utilized his resources to the maximum. But one does not have to wait through an uncertain lifetime to collect with the library. I have found it enormously rewarding, as have other friends of mine in the collecting world, to shear off sub-collections that tend to grow alongside main interests of one's library, place them with an institution, then continue to give, to add to and give them support in their new homes. It's like having grandchildren. The sense of identification is just as great, but the pressures of daily care are absent. If I may leave one thought for those of you here today, or those who may come to know the Charles Trumbull Hayden Library and its mission, it would be this. A book or collection of genuine value given to the Hayden Library would represent a permanent gift to the future. It is a gift that repeats itself for each generation of students and teachers. It may well be here 500 years from now, having meanwhile distributed its dividends to generation after generation that came and disappeared across the centuries. I have seen books and manuscripts in the Bodleian at Oxford and in Trinity Hall College in Cambridge, which have performed precisely that great service. Faculty and students have come and gone. The books remain to continue their basic mission to enrich the mainstreams of our Western thought with the inspirations of the past. The inscription on the Berlin Royal Library in the year 1780 was Nutrimentum Spiritus, or Food of the Spirit. I'm not sure whether this library building survived the bombings and the Russian artillery attacks, but it is significant that the inscription itself survives. That is the true meaning of a library, that the great thoughts of mankind shall survive forever, although the buildings may crumble into dust as the generations succeed each other. I think it is important that we stay mindful of the fact that the building we dedicate here today may someday be dust or rubble as the millions of yet unborn build new towers on our old foundations. But no matter how magnificent the towers of tomorrow, what they will carry inside will be our books, the books that we start with today, the books that we add tomorrow, the long rows of books that stretch back into the past to the linear B tablets of ancient Greece. And I'm always mindful in thinking of books that we as men and women are creatures of endless curiosity, speculating always on the multiple facets of our composition and our history and our world, and that only books can satisfy that boundless desire to know. Books certainly are the great treasures we have, the greatest treasures we have. In them are contained all religions and all amusements, all passions and all occupations, all that we know on earth and what we suspect of heaven. Thus it has come about during the centuries that a library is a kind of sacred place, another sort of temple, and that a book is an object of supreme stature. And this is why the burning of books or the destruction of a library always appears to be one of the greatest crimes that can be committed against civilization itself. Yet a book is a simple thing, as intimate as your hand, as satisfying as food and drink. And even as an Arab proverb has it, a book is like a garden carried in the pocket. Thus it is that everyone, rich or poor, can take such pleasure in a moment like this, when we gather to increase the wealth of the community, for that is precisely what we are doing. For the culture of a community, be it academic or lay, can be measured by the excellence of its library. The true wealth of a community lies in the extent and character of its library resources. And the vision of a community can be judged by the support, by its support of the continued growth of the library center. From all that I have seen and sensed in my few hours on this campus, the Charles Trumbull Hayden Library will be one of the brightest stars in the constellation of buildings that form this university. And as a tribute to this magnificent library, this new star in Tempe, and as a token of gratitude for the privilege of being here at this dedication, I would like to present an incunabulum edition of Diogenes Laertius's Lives of the Philosophers as a gift from Mrs. Strauss and myself. In this book, the author appropriately quotes Socrates as saying, "There was only one good, namely knowledge, and only one evil, namely ignorance." This book was printed in 1475, 9 years short of 5 centuries ago, and considered one of the finest specimens of the typographical art of Nicholas Jensen of Venice, who gave us our Roman typeface. President Durham, as one of the most beautiful volumes printed in the 15th century and rich in content, I'm sure it will find a suitable and comfortable home in the Charles Trumbull Hayden Library.
Thank you.